Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual, from the conservative perspective. And, Charlie, it's good to have you, as always. And we've got some pretty fun news for a double shot of the good martini. Number one, we see a story out of Politico today that there's only so much Democratic donor money to go around. And here's, well, the lead paragraph. With Democrats' grasp on the Senate increasingly tenuous and the House all but beyond reach, some top party donors and strategists are moving to do something in the midterm election as painful as it is cold-blooded. Admit the House can't be won and go all in to save the Senate. And if that weren't encouraging enough for Republicans, there's another story out of Time magazine about all these vulnerable senators and their response to the State of the Union message. They couldn't be running any further away from the president. You've got Mark Begich of Alaska saying if the president wants to come up to Alaska, he can. But he doesn't want to campaign with him. He wants to show him why his policies on Anwar are wrong. Mark Pryor's comment, overall, I'm disappointed with the president's State of the Union address because he was heavy on rhetoric but light on specifics about how we can move our country forward. Then he ticked off a list of things he disagrees with Obama on, including gun control, Keystone Pipeline, Syria, regulatory overreach. Mary Landrieu, Mark Udall, both of them distancing themselves as much as humanly possible. It's got to be encouraging for conservatives, especially given the fact that all these senators still voted for the stimulus. They still voted for Obamacare, and that's going to be pretty hard to get away from that.
Yes, I think it is encouraging. It demonstrates a couple of things. I think the first is that this is what happens to administrations. And after 5 or 6 years, they start to crumble a little bit, and the other side starts to pick up steam. That's just the pendulum. That's the way it works. We have a tendency in politics to pretend that what happened yesterday is going to happen forever. In 2005, after Bush won his second term, conservatives were convinced that they were going to be in power forever. There are all these books about the new conservative majority, the perpetual conservative majority, Bush country, and so on. But by 2006, that changed. And we saw the same thing with Obama in 2012, was this was the new progressive majority, and America was to be ushered into broad, sunlit, progressive upland by this president. And that hasn't happened, and it won't happen. And he has, I think, lost an awful lot of his magic, and so has the Democratic Party. And the second lesson is that although we have a tendency to focus on the presidency as the only election that matters, it strikes me that the Republican and Democratic parties have, in some senses, switched places. In the 1980s, it was almost impossible for a Democrat to win the White House. I know they didn't win one, but if you looked at the electoral mathematics, the cephalogy involved, it was pretty difficult. It was also difficult for Republicans to keep a grip on the House. And now we have an inverted scenario in which it does look tough for Republicans to win the White House. They will eke out a victory if they win in 2016, unless something dramatic changes. But they seem to have a lock on the House for the moment, at least, and they look like they're going to do okay in the Senate. And, you know, that counts too. That really does. And the Democrats have perhaps finally noticed that they can't necessarily win the House back just because they have the president.
Charlie, some folks were already talking in the wake of the State of the Union address about this being the start of a really long lame duck period. If the Democrats essentially concede the House now, the president is at best stuck in the scenario that he's been for the last 3+ years. So his agenda is pretty much done if the Democrats adopt this strategy, right?
Well, unless Republicans agree with him, and they might do on issues like immigration, I hope they don't, but they might do, then yes, the days of Barack Obama setting the agenda are over. And if we saw this in the State of the Union, I think my colleague Ramesh Panuru was absolutely right when he said this was a Clintonian State of the Union. It was a generic, waffly, middle-of-the-road, precisionless State of the Union that effectively acknowledged that for the next 2.5 years, he is done. And that is great news for those of us who think his agenda is a disaster.
You tipped your hand a little bit on the second martini, so let's get there. And Jim and I talked about this a little bit earlier in the week, and that's that at a time when exactly 3% of Americans believe immigration reform needs to be at the top of the congressional agenda, it appears that House Republicans are bound and determined to move forward on this, and it looks like they're pushing forward with legislation that would certainly legalize the approximately 11 million illegals, but possibly even allow the pathway to citizenship, which some people say is really no difference, because if you legalized, eventually there'd be a subsequent push for citizenship anyway. And the question politically, of course, is why are the Republicans doing this when it doesn't seem like there's a ton of advantage for them politically or policy-wise? Charlie, I know you've talked about this a lot. What's your sense of what the Republicans are doing here?
I think many of the Republicans believe that they have to do this in order to be viable as a party in the future. I don't think that that is true, but I understand the temptation, having lost the White House for a second time. I also think there are some in the Republican Party who want to do it as a matter of politics. It shouldn't be underestimated, the sort of Chamber of Commerce wing of the party and the more right of, you know, moderately right of center, purely economically based people in the party who think that it's the right idea. I think it's not. And I think that if you do polling on this, as you suggested, you find that really people don't care about it. I mean, the story of Obama's second term, and to an extent his first term with health care reform, but the story of Obama's second term has been perpetually focusing in on issues that people don't care about. Gun control, people don't care about. It's just not a priority for them. Immigration, likewise, is just not a priority for them. And nor is the environment, nor is so-called climate change. It's just people don't care, frankly. So for Republicans to pick this up when, A, people don't care, and B, they are in arguably the most powerful position that they've been in since the president was elected in 2008, it strikes me as frankly, tactically bizarre.
And let's tie it back into the first martini, given the momentum the GOP would seem to have right now. If, in fact, this moves forward, they pass comprehensive reform, whether it's in pieces or in one big bill, what's the impact on their momentum? What's the impact on the base?
Well, this is exactly the point, is you need to be able to stand up there as a party, as any politician, and make people believe, if they vote for you, the change that they want to see will happen. Now, Obama did that very well. He hasn't really affected it, with the exception of health care, but he did that extremely well, for better or for worse. Huge swathes of the population believed that his election was going to fundamentally change things. Now, Republicans are already jaded. They've seen the state grow and grow and grow for decades now, and Republicans incapable of reversing it. If the party leading up to an election in which they're going to promise, one suspects, to reverse the Obama tide and to try and undo the health care law, if they choose, when they don't have to pass a bill that is, and you think this is unpopular nationally, it is extremely unpopular with Republicans, to pass a bill that legalizes illegal immigrants, goodness knows what the fallout will be among those who really should be turning out in 2014 to try and change the way things work.
Now let's move on to the third and crazy martini now. And one of the other things the president mentioned in his State of the Union address on Tuesday evening was the average salary for women was still 77% of what men make. And he says he needs to pursue more policies to level that playing field. He says we can't be living in a Mad Men type world here in terms of gender pay. Both Hot Air and McClatchy doing a good job of kind of putting the myth to this, with Hot Air citing economists as well as feminists pointing out that it's not like a man and a woman standing side by side doing the exact same job make vastly different pay. It's that men take more dangerous and high stress jobs. They choose higher paying career fields and that men tend to work more hours in a week. And then McClatchy went on to point out that even in the Obama White House, women overall make 91 cents for every dollar that men make. And the assumption there is that it's for the same reasons as mentioned in these economic studies. So what do you make of the president going back to that statistic? And do you suspect there's much momentum to that?
Look, the president is not a stupid man. He knows as well as anybody that what he said was untrue. And he knows that it gave a false impression. The statistic that he cited is not only untrue in the way in which it was cited, but it's untrue, it is rude. As you say, there is no 23-cent gap for men and women doing the same job. There is, studies show, maybe a 5 or 6 sense gap. Now, that's not okay, although it does tend to come down to things like different bargaining talents and aggressiveness and so on and so forth, which are much more difficult to change by law. He's speaking to people who want to be misled. They don't want to know the truth. The sort of person who watches the State of the Union and really responds to that line is not interested in whether it's true or not. They already view the president's opponents and the Republican Party and the conservative movement as hostile towards women, as antediluvian in its attitudes towards the marketplace. The Mad Men line was put in there deliberately. It was reasonably clever. The average person who is going to act on that doesn't want to know the truth. Republicans probably should respond to it, however, because your casual viewer will listen to that and they're not going to debunk it or read Hot Air or McClatchy or the Independent Women's Forum or any of the economists about this. So it is an important thing to push back on. But why does he do it? He does it for the same reason he pretends there's a war on women, because it seems to work.
Charlie, at this point, his administration, he's into his sixth year now, and this statistic that he keeps bringing out hasn't changed. So after a while that you've been in office, you are essentially admitting that nothing has changed on your watch if you're still trying to posit that this statistic is true. And isn't this the same president that claimed the Lilly Ledbetter Act solved all this?
Well, that's a reasonable point. The point of his bringing it up perpetually, of course, is to make it seem as if his presidency would have been perfect had he not been thwarted, that the people who thwarted it have Republican by their name, and that the way to fix it is to get rid of the Republicans in Congress so that he can do what he wants. That's pretty standard, you know, politics 101. Having said that, he does have an issue, as you say, because they passed a bill that was supposed to fix this, and it didn't. But when has that ever stopped a politician from pretending that, the, you know, if only the wreckers weren't there, something would have changed?
I guess so. Charlie, as always, great to have you with us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Charlie Cook of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.